Hi, I'm Elizabeth, and we're here tonight with Melissa, and she's going to share some strength and hope with us by telling us her story. And this is the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right. Well, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm an alcoholic. And today we have Melissa from Florida with us, and she is here, and she volunteered to share her experience, strength, and hope in recovery by telling us her story. And so with that, I'll give you Melissa. So just let us know, like, what got you in the rooms, what got you here, what made you stay, and, like, what your life is like now.
Okay. So my name's Melissa. I'm an addict. I've been clean now for 3.5 years. My childhood wasn't normal. Both my parents were addicts. And, you know, just growing up that way, you know, kind of walking on eggshells growing up because you didn't know who was going to snap and who wasn't. Or if you were going to get beat that day for doing nothing. So it was like, it wasn't a good childhood. My mom and dad got divorced when I was 6, and I had a 2-year-old brother. So, like, my mom, like, went on her drinking binge and stuff. So there'd be random guys at the house, and I was constantly taking care of my brother. Like, I learned how to make scrambled eggs when I was 6 years old, and, you know, I had to do what I had to do to survive and take care of my brother. So, like, I grew up at a very fast age. I mean, a very young age. I grew up fast.
Yeah.
Let me see. So when I was about, before that all happened, when before we moved and stuff, like when I was 5 years old, I was getting molested by a little girl down the street. Uh-huh. So I would try to tell my family, but it was like getting brushed off.
Yeah.
So I learned how to wear a mask on my face because everything always had to be happy and nothing was going on. Like, I wasn't allowed to say how my dad was beating the crap out of my mom. And I wasn't allowed to say anything because what happened behind closed doors stayed behind closed doors.
I had a very similar experience growing up. So I get that.
Yeah. So it, you know, that's not how it is now, which is good. But, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, that's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned how to wear a mask on my face to let everyone think that everything was good. And really, I was dying inside at a young age. I started experimenting with drugs when I was like 12, and I tried marijuana for the first time, and I kind of liked it, but did it. So like, it didn't stick with me, and I was just like, yeah. And then we moved to Pittsburgh when I was 13.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had another kid, and, you know, my teenage years, I felt so out of place. I didn't feel like I belonged. And my mom was always telling me to get out of her face because I looked like my dad. And it was like I wasn't being loved the way I should be.
Yeah.
You know, and my little brothers were getting all these attentions and stuff. And like, I had to fend for myself about everything. Like, I even got a job when I was 15 so I could do, you know, get clothes and, you know, hang out with friends or whatever. And then my brothers were always getting things given to them. Like, I had a curfew, they didn't, which was crazy because I was the oldest.
Yeah.
When I was about 16 or 17, I was raped. I was raped multiple times as growing up. Like, one by my friend's brother, one by my cousin, and one by my ex-boyfriend, and then 2 other times by people I don't know. Like, I literally was, the one time I was riding my bicycle home from school, and this guy, like, knocked me off my bike, dragged me into the woods, and raped me, and pretty much just left me there.
Wow.
So, like, I'm so happy I didn't die or him trying to kill me.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, yeah, I was scary and stuff, and I believe I was 12 at that time. But, like, so I have all the emotions and stuff bottled up inside, and mm-hmm. I didn't know how to get rid of it, and I wasn't allowed to go to parties and stuff, so I wasn't drinking, I wasn't doing drugs. Like, I was confined in my house. I started playing softball and stuff like that, got straight A's in school. Like, I tried to do everything I could so my mom would love me and tell me she was proud of me. And I never got that. I started writing poems to get my emotions out. Mm-hmm. And most of them, like, I read back into them. Most of them was pretty much about killing myself or I wanted to die. So it was just like, oh, my goodness. When I was 18 years old, I thought I found the love of my life. And
don't we all?
Right. But I ended up getting pregnant and he had turned 21. Mm-hmm. And he told me like he was leaving me for this other girl. So of course, like I got all upset like and stuff, and I ended up having a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And I didn't tell anybody because nobody knew I was even pregnant. And since I was 18, they didn't have to call my parents.
Yeah.
So they gave me a DNC and I did all that. And then I met my son's dad and, you know, I thought I was in love again. I was like, oh, this is what love is.
Yeah.
So, I had a full scholarship to go to Carlo University for my softball. And I was like, oh, let me just take a semester off. I'll go back the following semester.
Yeah.
Well, during that semester off, I got pregnant again. Mm-hmm. So I did go back to school in the spring and I was pregnant. Everyone's going to dance clubs, partying and stuff. Here I am in bed watching movies and vegging out and, you know, taking care of my kid.
Yeah.
That's in my stomach. So he was due in August, and then when May came around,
did you stay sober through your pregnancy while he was yes. growing inside of you? Okay.
Yeah, they call me a late bloomer. But I was, I was clean. I didn't do anything. I didn't even smoke. I quit smoking cigarettes when I was pregnant with them.
Yeah.
And in May, I started having contractions. And they're like, oh, they're just Braxton Hicks contractions. That's normal. Well, I got them so bad, like I collapsed to the ground. So they took me to the hospital by ambulance. And they were like, oh, my God, you're dilating already. And I was like, my son's not due till August. Why am I dilating now? And then they weren't sure. So they, pumped me up with steroids just in case he came out early. So his lungs would be fully developed and stuff like that. And they gave me this new drug they were trying to help stop contractions. Well, that didn't help because on May 3rd, I ended up giving birth to my first son.
Yeah.
They had to fly him to the other hospital because he only weighed 1 pound, 8 ounces and his lungs weren't fully developed. So he had to go to the NICU. So they sent him to Children's Hospital. And then he was in there for about 4.5 months mm-hmm. until they said I could take him home. And we had him home for 3 weeks. And I just had come home from work. I put him on my chest like I always did. Like when he was home, he's on a breathing, he was an oxygen monitor. And they said sometimes the monitor will go off and it doesn't mean anything. And we're like, okay. So that night the monitor went off and we just thought, it didn't mean anything. And then I looked at him and his lips were turning blue. So I had to hurry up and call 911 and his dad tried giving him CPR because he stopped breathing.
Yeah.
His dad was freaking out because he didn't know how to really do it. And like at this time, I'm 19, his dad's 17. So like, we didn't know what we were doing. The lady on the phone was telling me how to do it. I'm explaining to him. He's like, I can't fucking do this.
Yeah.
You have to do it. So I took the phone and I started giving my son CPR. And since I was going to school for biology pre-med, I kind of knew things.
Yeah.
And whenever his dad had given him CPR, his stomach extended, but didn't go back down. So they told me to press on his stomach, and I did, and he aspirated. So once that happened, I kind of figured he was gone because, when you aspirate, like, it goes into your lungs and everything, and it's hard for you to breathe. So, I continued to give him CPR, which seemed like a lifetime, but it was only 5 minutes before the paramedics came because the hospital was, like, 2 minutes down from the street. They, bring him back and stuff. We didn't see him or anything. And then the priest came in and I was like, oh no, this is not good.
Yeah.
So the priest came in, he's like, I'm sorry, your son's gone. And I just remember collapsing to the floor screaming, and that was it. And then they said I could go back in the room and hold him because I wanted to see him one last time. And I was holding him, and he was covered in his favorite blankie, and he just got really cold, and I was crying, and I was like, my son's cold. You need to keep him warm. I don't know what else you can do to keep him warm. So, like, it wasn't really registering in my head that he was gone. I was pretty much still in shock.
Yeah, that's what grief does to you.
Yeah, so once that happened, that's when I started drinking. Mm-hmm. I went on a drinking binge for, like, 2 weeks straight until I decided to kill myself because I didn't know what else to do. And I ended up in the psych ward. I was there for about a month and a half. And then me and his dad split up. I moved to North Carolina, and he stayed in Pennsylvania. And then as I was living in North Carolina, he found out where I was at, and he's like, I'm coming to get you. So I was like, okay. So I go back up to Pennsylvania. And then that night, I ended up getting pregnant. I find out I'm pregnant, obviously, like 2 months later, I find out I was pregnant again. And I was so scared because I didn't want what happened to my first son happened to my second child.
Yeah.
So I stopped drinking. I stopped smoking again. I, you know, was clean and thought everything was going to be okay. And he came out a month early, but he was like 6 pounds, 2 ounces. So they said he was a healthy weight and his lungs were pretty much fully developed because he was due in June, the middle of June. I had him May 14th. And I just remember them like asking me, what did I name my kid? And I'm like, what did I have? And they're like, it's a boy. So I was like, his name is Bryce Jordan. They're like, okay. So they had to life flight him to Children's Hospital again. And it was the same doctors that took care of my first kid.
Yeah.
But Brycey was only in there for about, I would say, 2-3 weeks. He wasn't in there very long.
Mm-hmm.
I brought him home and everything was good with him. The only thing wrong with him is he had a lazy eye. So they said they could fix that. And I was like, okay, that's good. But he was doing good, really healthy. They told me his EEG was bad though, so he might be slow. He might have some learning disabilities. And I was like, all right. So
how old were you at this point?
That time I just had turned 21.
Okay. So you were legal age of drinking.
Yes. So my brother had moved in with me to help me with my son because me and my son's dad split up again.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother moved in with me and I ended up drinking every night. So I didn't think I had a problem because I was still going to work in the morning and I didn't drink until my son went to sleep.
I was the same way. I would go to work. I would stay sober all day. As soon as I got home, though, I was drinking to make up for the whole rest of the day.
Right?
You know?
So it was just like, okay. But I didn't have a problem.
Oh, no. Because we don't.
I was at home.
We
right?
didn't. Yeah.
I was socially drinking.
Yeah, that's normal.
So, and I thought it was normal anyways, because that's what my mom did. She drank every day after work.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay.
Well, it's also, you know, what you see like in movies and TV shows. You're like, oh, it's normal for me to go home and have a glass of wine or a whole bottle. Like, that's normal, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And that's what I did. I always had a case of beer in the fridge, and I always had Goldschlager and vodka in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh my God, Goldschlager. I forgot about that.
That was the good stuff. But, yeah, so everything was good and, you know, a couple years passed and I believe I was, I gotta get a calculator out. let's see, how old was I? So 2003. All right. So I was 24. So like 3 years passed by and, you know, I was still doing my drinking thing. And then I had a one night stand and I got pregnant.
You are a fertile woman.
Yes, that's what they say about the Puerto Ricans. We're very fertile. So I ended up getting pregnant and I wasn't with the guy. And then the doctors gave me like a week difference. So I didn't know if it was my other kid's dad or if it was this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, this is great. Like, I don't know who my baby's dad is. I said, I didn't want to be one of those people. I said, but I guess I am.
Yeah.
So I ended up having, he was due in the end of June. And I ended up having them May 12th. And this time when I was having contractions, my uterus would rupture every time. So
that's what happened to my mom when I was born.
Yeah.
Yeah, her uterus erupted and I was like drowning inside of her. We had to do emergency C-section. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what happened to my son. I guess that happened with Bryce, but with my youngest, they opened me up and he was out of my uterus under my rib cage. Mm-hmm. And they said it took him a minute to find him. And I'm like, my insides aren't that big. How can you not find a kid?
Yeah.
But he came out. He was like 19 inches long and he was six pounds, 3 ounces. Mm-hmm. So they said that was like normal weight and stuff, but he still got life flighted because he was without oxygen for a long time.
Yeah.
So I find out he didn't have a sucker swallow reflex. He didn't have a gag reflex. They said he couldn't hear, he couldn't see, and that he had cerebral palsy. So I was like, oh my goodness. And this all was because of what happened with my pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So that was on May 12th, 2003. And like I said, I was 24 years old. I ended up taking him home. He had all these different monitors and stuff on him. He had a feeding tube because he had to eat through his stomach. You know, it was just a lot of work for a 24-year-old to do between two kids. So I decided to give Bryce to his dad who lived a block away from me. I was like, okay, you take care of Bryce. I'll take care of Marshall. I want Bryce to get the loving that he deserves and needs. I didn't think he was getting enough attention mm-hmm. that I thought he should get.
Yeah.
You know, because growing up, I didn't get that attention. So I wanted to make sure my son knew he was loved.
Yeah.
And, after I gave him to his dad, that was back in 2005. We were getting ready to, you know, get their birthday parties together because they were 2 days, you know, 3 years, 2 days apart. And in March, Marshall ended up getting a temperature of 105. And I was like, okay, give him some Tylenol and you know, see if it dropped. It didn't drop. I was putting cool washcloth on him and stuff. So finally I called one of his nurses because he had 24-hour day care through nurses.
Yeah.
And I called one of the nurses and they're like, you know, if it don't drop, you need to call the 911. So I said, okay. So I gave it another hour. It didn't drop. So I called 911 and we went to Children's Hospital and they didn't put him in the NICU. They just put him in a regular room. They put him on like a whole bunch of ice packs and stuff to try to get his temperature to drop. Well, I guess it wasn't dropping the way they needed it to. So they transferred him to NICU. And I had to go into another room. And then the next day they came in and they told me he stopped breathing. They wanted to know if I wanted them to continue CPR. And I said, yes, please do whatever you can to save my kid. I said, I can't have this happen to me again. So it seemed like forever. And then they came back out and they're like, he's still not responding. His major organs are shutting down. We can continue to do it. They said, but if he does come back, he's going to be pretty much a vegetable because he's been dead for so long. So I said, no, just stop. And, you know, the grievance lady came in and she's like, you know, if there's anything you need, then let me know. She's like, I know exactly what you're going through. And I was like, well, do you have kids? She's like, no. I said, so how the fuck do you know what I'm going through?
Yeah.
I was like, you know, this is my second child that you just told me is not making it. So they came in, they said, you know, we just pronounced him dead. And I'm like, okay, I went outside, I lit up a cigarette, I called my best friend, and I was like, it happened again. She's like, what? I was like, Marshall's dead. And she's screaming. And like, I literally said it like that because like, I was in shock. I didn't know how to feel. Like, how am I supposed to react?
You had a wall up. You're like, I've done this before, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I was just like, okay, here we go again, you know, and everyone's like, you should have been more upset and stuff. I said, I was upset. I'm like, you just told me my kid's dead. Like, what? How? You can't tell someone how to grieve, though.
Yeah, no, you can't.
And so I was like, okay, so we buried him and everything. I read his eulogy, and I was doing good until I heard my little brother and my son start crying, and then I started crying. And then about 25, 26, when I was like 26, I started dating these guys that were on drugs because I meet them at the bars.
Yeah.
And then thinking that they're like going to be the one.
Yeah. Oh, we love a drug dealer. We love a drug dealer. We always date them. They're great.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you get your shit for free.
Hell yeah.
So I ended up dating this one guy. He went to jail for possession and other stuff. And he was in there for about a year or something. But, like, I knew he was on heroin, and I said I would never touch that shit. Like, I was doing coke and smoking weed and drinking, but I'd never touch heroin.
Mm-hmm. That's how it always starts.
Right. Like, so I broke up with this guy. Right. No, I'll never do that. I said, I'll never do anything. And then I started dating this other guy in 2007, and I was kind of tricked into using heroin the first time. He said it was a fentanyl patch that was dried up. And I didn't know at the time fentanyl patch was synthetic heroin anyways.
Yeah.
But, he's like, just try it. And so I said, okay. Well, he left me there with this bag of so-called fentanyl patch. And I went like this and licked it. And it freaked me out
because
I didn't know what the hell was supposed to happen. And I ended up flushing it down the toilet because, like, my heart was pounding. It was racing. I think I was just so scared. Like, I got myself so scared and worked up that I was like, oh, my God, I'm dying.
Yeah.
So, like, I laid there and was like, oh, my God. And I flushed it down the toilet. He came home the next day, and he's like, did you like it? And I was like, I flushed it down the toilet. He's like, what the fuck's wrong with you? Oh, my God. So he went and got more, and he's like, here, I'll pour some out. You snort it. And I'm like, okay. That was it.
Yeah.
As soon as that hit me, I was like, okay. All my feelings went away. I didn't have to worry about anything. Because that's also this time my son's dad had took him to California. So, like, he's on the other, you know. I felt like I lost all my kids.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck it. I started using heroin. I started shooting up, like, 6 months after. And then I went on this binge for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, it was cheaper than buying pills
because
I would get the blues and those were like $35-$40, you know, and you can get a bag of heroin for 10. So it was like, which one do I want?
Yeah.
So I can't really remember what happened over those 10 years. Like, it was such a blur. Like, I remember shoveling snow so my kid could get football shoes and stuff like that. Like, whatever I did, I always made sure my son had first.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to be sick that day, oh, well, as long as my son was taken care of. And then, let's see, I moved down here 5 years ago because I wanted to get clean. So I moved back to Florida to get clean. I left my boyfriend. He was in jail at the time again. So, like, we broke up. And I was doing good down here. Like, I even went to got Suboxone and from the doctor, and I was doing okay. But, like, I have back issues because my spine is deteriorating. So they ended up putting me back on pain meds. And then I was in so much pain that one day, the guy that I was seeing in Florida was like, here, I'll get you a bag. And I was like, okay. And I went back to, you know, started back off to the races again.
Yeah.
And
so what made you like realize you had a problem? Like, what made you be like, okay, it's time to get clean? Like, did you overdose? What happened?
2 years after I moved down here, it was May 30th of 2017. I was going back and forth. Still didn't think I had a problem. You know, I was like, I can stop anytime I want to. Yeah. I'd be clean for 10 days and then I'd start using again.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it's just the weekends and then it would start all over.
I think everyone has that in their story.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just the weekend. I can stop. And then it ends up being like 3 months.
Yeah.
If not longer.
Yeah.
But on May 30th, that's when like the fentanyl started coming out and stuff. And my drug dealer told me, don't take as much as you usually do. This one's really strong. So I was like, okay. So I literally did like this much. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, here comes the warm and fuzzies. And then the next thing you know, I wake up with a nurse on top of me giving me CPR. Mm-hmm. So like, that's what changed.
Yeah.
That day was May 30th, the 2017. My dad wanted me to go to rehab and stuff like that. I said, no. I said, I already know what they're going to tell me what to do. I was like, they're going to tell me to go to meetings, get a sponsor, do 90 and 90, work the steps, you know, do service work. I was like, I already know what they're going to say. Because like in between those times I had gone to jail and they sent me to treatment instead of leaving me in jail. So like, and they had, you know, the treatment, they tell you all that stuff. They have H and I. So, that's why I knew what they were going to tell me what to do already. And, you know, that's what changed me. That overdose changed my life because I knew like if something would happen to me, my son would be devastated and I didn't want him to, experience that again. So I started going to meetings. I got a sponsor, started working the steps, but like I did my steps as schoolwork. I didn't attach my emotions because like that, I never really grew up having to deal with like, I wasn't allowed to show my feelings. Mm-hmm. So like, I always grew up being happy. So like, I just, you know, wrote everything nonchalantly and whatever.
Yeah.
And, but like things are doing good. I ended up writing the poems and got my book published and, we started a nonprofit organization called Wings of Recovery Network. And what we do is we help other people struggling with substance abuse get into treatment. Mm-hmm. So like, that's what I've been doing the last 3.5 years is, you know, helping others and continuing to do my step work. I'm on step 4 again, which really sucks. But
I just did a step 4 actually. So I get where you're at.
Oh, it's horrible. But I know that's what I got to do to, you know, keep staying strong and keep doing what I'm doing. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and my mom finally told me she's proud of me and I've been waiting for that for like 40 years.
Yeah.
So
what was it like going through the steps? Like the first time you said it was like schoolwork, but what made it like actually change for you? Like what made it change your life?
I finally, like, doing the steps, even with schoolwork, it changed my life, you know, because, I was still being honest and open about everything.
Yeah. It's like that surface level. The first time you do it, it's, like, very surface, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, like, you know, it's like, okay. And, like, the way I was doing it, like, my sponsor, like, pushed me. So I was literally doing a step a month.
Yeah.
So, like, I didn't really get to absorb what I was writing down or anything. Like I just wrote it down and was like, here you go.
Yeah.
But I had my spiritual awakening when I had 18 months clean. Mm-hmm. Because like I struggle with, like I believe in God, but I don't want him to be my higher power because all this shit that happened to me.
Yeah.
So I'm still struggling with that. So like my higher power right now are my kids that are in heaven. So because they told me to find something that is loving and caring and won't hurt you and stuff like that. So I'm like, oh, my babies, they won't hurt me. So finally, when I had 18 months, it was like, ding, that's your spiritual. That's who your higher power is. Because like, I kept fighting about it. Mm-hmm. And after that, when I started working my steps again, I got a new sponsor. And she told me to take my time. And she told me that I have to be open and honest and definitely be willing to put my emotions to what I write down.
Yeah.
And that's why it's been a little longer for me to actually get my step work done because I start doing it and then all these feelings start rushing in and I'm like, oh crap, I ain't trying to deal with this right now.
Yeah. So is this what you're currently going through? Like your emotions are like, you're starting to bubble over a little bit.
Yeah. I even Boil started over. Going to therapy. Yeah. I knew what you meant. But I even started going to therapy because it is like the emotions like are just too much. Like feelings suck.
Yeah. I'm pro therapy. Cause like going through these steps, like they bring up a lot, you know, and like some of it is like you can get relief by doing the 12 steps, but some of it's like you just need somebody to just go talk to and just sit there and cry, you know, and get angry and like not feel like your sponsor is like trying to tell you about your defects. You know what I mean?
Right. Sometimes you need the outside help.
Yeah.
And that's what I was struggling. Like, my struggling with my feelings is crying.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or being mad. Like, I really am bubbly all the time. That's how I've always been. But, like, now people are starting to realize, okay, Melissa's wearing her mask today. She's not really – this is not how she's feeling.
Yeah.
So, like, I'll tell them to ask me. Like, next month, October 14th, will be my first son's angelversary. Mm-hmm. And that's always hard for me.
Yeah.
So, like, I start sharing in the rooms. Like, hey, if I start isolating, this is why. Please get me out of my, you know, get me out of that bubble in that situation. Like, I need to go and do stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I can't be by myself.
Yeah. That's recovery, asking for help. You know, not being alone with stuff like that, because it's really hard to be alone, because you were so alone with it for so long, you know, and like, it's so nice that we have the rooms and we have people in recovery to like call us when we're not okay, you know?
Right. And what's great is like my sponsor, well, it's not great, but my sponsor had also lost a child. So like she can relate to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's funny, you know, how like, God puts us with people like us, huh?
Yeah, my therapist even lost a child and is in recovery. So
that's awesome. Not that I lost children, but you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah. It's just great that you have someone that you can relate to, because like when I first started coming into the rooms, I was like, you know, looking at everything that we didn't have, you know.
Looking for the differences, not the similarities.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just had a brain fart.
It's okay.
But yeah, I was looking for the differences instead of looking for the similarities. And then I found out, like, if you keep doing that, it's going to take you back out.
Oh, yeah.
So I started listening to everyone's story to see what I can relate to and what the similarities I had instead of looking for the differences.
Yeah.
And that's what's great. Like, you know, I'm growing up in the rooms, like I'm realizing what I want in a relationship, like any type of relationship.
Yeah.
And I'm able to speak up. I used to be a big time people pleaser.
Oh yeah.
And
same.
Now I'm not. It's like, okay, if I don't want to do this, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care if you say get mad at me or whatever, you'll get over it. And if you don't, then you don't belong in my life to be honest.
I had a friend who looked at me one time and was like, it's okay if you say no. And I was like,
right.
What? You're not going to be mad at me? It was so weird. I was like, I can say no. I don't have to drive you somewhere. It was so weird to me.
Right. Because you're so afraid that they're going to get mad at you or disown you or say, okay, bye.
Yeah.
See ya.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, like, that's at least why I was always afraid to say no to people, because I always thought I was going to be neglected or isolated or abandoned.
Because it's all about us. It's how it affects us. It's weird how we turn that around to always about us. It's like, well, I'm trying to please you, but, like, it's really because I need your validation.
Right. And now it's like, okay, you don't like it, then, oh, well, you'll get over it.
Yep.
So, like, I'll – because I even tell people, like – you know, if someone asks you to do something and if it's against you spiritually, morally, physically, and mentally or emotionally, then you can say no.
Yeah.
I said, you don't want to do stuff that's going to hurt you that way.
Yeah.
So, I said, it's okay.
Yeah. So do you sponsor women in the program?
I was sponsoring this lady and she actually was murdered on May 19th of this year.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
So, they're still investigating because they know her husband did it, but he had her cremated really quickly and all this other stuff. So they're, you know, they're not sure if they'll be able to pin it.
Your
on him.
Life would be a really entertaining TV show. I'm not going to lie. I would watch it. I would
My
watch
mom
it.
Said the same thing.
I would watch it for sure. It actually sounds like TV shows I watch.
Right. My mom's like, oh my God. Every time I talk to you, it's like a TV show. You always have something going on.
Oh, yeah, because we're dramatic. It's awesome.
Right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, so I was sponsoring this other girl, but she went back out. I still talk to her to make sure she's okay and stuff.
Yeah.
She literally lives two blocks away from me.
Yeah.
So, I check on her, make sure she's okay, and, you know, letting her know that I'm still here for her no matter what. When she's ready to get clean, I will be here for her.
Yeah. That's always... my sponsor's always like, look, they might not be ready, but at least they know where they can come, you know?
Right.
So Wings of Recovery, what is that all about? When did you start that? And what is it?
Okay, so Wings of Recovery Network is a nonprofit organization. We started it November of 2018. Mm-hmm. And what it is me and my partner, we're both in recovery, and we wanted to help other people get the treatment and detox and get help with sober living when they're ready for it. So what started it was because his brother paid for him to go to treatment. Mm-hmm. And it was like $90,000 or something.
Yeah.
And for me, I didn't go to treatment, but there's so many people that don't have insurance. They can't get into treatment.
Yeah.
So we try to get them scholarships and we pay for them we'll pay for their plane flight to get to a treatment center that they've been accepted to.
Yeah.
So we make sure they've been accepted to the program. We have them sign release forms first, so that way we can talk to the treatment center. Mm-hmm. And we make sure, we fly people from anywhere, cause we're not affiliated with any treatment facilities or anything. So we can fly people from Florida to California or California to Iowa, or, you know, just as long as we know that they've been accepted to that treatment center. And then we stay in touch with them afterwards.
Yeah.
So just to see, hey, are you still doing good? Do you need help with anything? And then once we get bigger, we want to start hiring them and having them volunteer for us. And then from volunteering, get hired to do certain things.
That's cool.
So we've been working on that. Right now, it's just me, my partner. You know, so it's really hard. But last year we helped 32 people get into recovery.
That's awesome. That's a big number for one year being open.
Right. And then this year has been slow because of the COVID and everyone's going back out. They're not asking for help and stuff.
Yeah.
So we've helped 19 people this year, which is still not bad.
That's not bad. For COVID, that's not bad.
Right. And we got four scholarships for people. I actually got, unfortunately, my cousin's out there and he needs help. So I'm trying to get him a scholarship now.
Yeah.
But that's what's great about knowing different people in different treatment centers and different states and stuff. Because then we're like, oh, you know, do you take people that don't have insurance? How much does it cost? You know, do you do scholarships? Like, we get, especially in Florida, we go and we tour the facilities first. Because mm-hmm. we want to make sure, we would go there before we send someone to that one. Refer someone to that one.
That's smart.
Because, I wouldn't want to go to a place where it's all about, okay, we're going to play video games and do this and do that. And you have no work on yourself.
Yeah.
Because that's what recovery is it's a selfish program. You got to work on yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. I heard in a meeting recently, and it's stuck with me, that if getting sober was easy, I wouldn't do it, you know, because I'm proud of myself that I took the time and actually dug deep and actually worked my ass off to stay sober. You know, I wouldn't stay sober if it was easy. Because it has to be hard, and it has to be trudge and trenches so that I can actually feel rewarded within myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think if it was easy, a lot of people would be doing it.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's why it's hard, because when you start getting deep down inside mm-hmm. and start, you know, seeing who you were while you're using, it gets scary.
Yeah.
And recovery or sobriety is scary because it's something new.
Yeah.
We've never done it before.
Yeah. So what's your life like today? What do you do today, to stay sober? What is it like right now?
Okay. So I still do what I do like I was new. Mm-hmm. I still go to my meetings. I don't do as many meetings now that when I first started. But I still do 4 or 5 a week, mm-hmm. depending on what time I get home. And plus with COVID, I do a lot of Zoom meetings. I don't do in-person meetings because I have, I get bronchitis and stuff every year. So I don't want to catch COVID or the corona.
Yeah.
So I try to stay away from people. So I go to my meetings. I talked earlier, I still do my step work. I reach out to different people when I'm struggling. I have my sponsor. I try to help other females, even males too, when they need it. Like, I can direct them to the right people to talk to.
Yeah.
And then all of my, our organization, our nonprofit organization, is what really helps me stay clean, is because I'm constantly helping somebody else.
Yeah.
And helping other people is what keeps me clean the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just makes me feel happy, you know?
Yeah.
I'm proud of myself. I'm like, yay, we helped somebody else. Hopefully they sticks with them and they stay in touch. Mm-hmm. Like, one person that we helped is actually my roommate now.
Awesome. That's so cool. I love how that happens. You become friends with all your people in recovery, you know? Because it's like, oh my God, my people. Where have you been all my life?
Right? You feel like you finally fit in where you thought you didn't fit in anywhere.
Yeah.
And I just moved, so now I have a bigger place that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on getting my license back. So I haven't had my license since 2008, but that didn't stop me from driving.
Of course not. I get that.
But, like, now I don't drive and stuff, you know, because I don't want to get in trouble and then have it suspended
longer. Well, you're, like, a principled person today, so that would make sense. Why you wouldn't be driving? You're working on getting your license.
Yeah, because my dad's like, you have to drive. I'm like, nope, not happening.
Yep. That's awesome. Well, and then
I have a good relationship with my mom now. It's getting a lot better. Like, I talk to her more often and stuff. So,
that's like, awesome.
You know, being in recovery helps you build relationships that you didn't have before.
Yeah. So if a newcomer was sitting right in front of you right now and had a similar story to yours, or, you know, hasn't even gone through some of the things that you've gone through, but clearly has a problem, what would you say to them?
Well, what would I say to them? Like, I don't want to be cliche and be like, take it one day at a time. And
yeah.
Stuff. I try not to do all those and say the sayings and stuff, but I listen to them and let them know, like, they're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
If they ever need anything, my phone's always on. Mm-hmm. They can always reach out to me no matter what. I tell them to get other phone numbers, though, just in case they can't get a hold of me. Do the meetings and try to share. Even if you don't want to, you need to share. And then you'll realize that other people relate to you. You're not the only one.
Yeah.
So.
That's cool.
And I just tell them, you know, stay strong, and they're stronger than what they think they are.
Yeah. What was the one thing that you heard when you were new that has stuck with you? Because there's always something that sticks with us.
Yeah. It was, this lady, she just had picked up 24 years mm-hmm. when I first came into the rooms. It was actually my first meeting. She came over and gave me her key tag. And she is like, this is the hope for you, hon. You can do this. I know you can. She's like, you are strong and you're a beautiful woman. So, like, that stuck with me, you know?
Yeah.
Because I didn't get, like, generally get those. Like, people tell you you're beautiful or stuff, but usually they want something for saying that shit.
Yeah.
But, like, this was, like, genuinely caring people. And, like, she even made me go out with them that night and everything. Like, she's like, you're coming with us. You're not saying no. And I was like, oh, okay.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Because I don't know if you do this because you're probably staying inside because of COVID. But recently I've been doing that with people, like, kind of been like, come on, we're going to dinner. Let's go. And they're, like, so weird about it. Then they come and they have so much fun. And I'm like, see, just keep doing it. Just keep coming, you know? So.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't been doing it lately. Because, like, my son, my boss's wife, our girlfriend, she found out she had breast cancer at the beginning of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been going through chemo and stuff. So I have to watch who I'm around because I don't want to get her sick.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So. But we did go out to lunch, or we went out to dinner on Thursday because it was our first live women's meeting again. It was great.
So are you part of a women's group?
Yes.
So what was it like when you came into the rooms? Were you like, ew, woman, or were you like, I need women? Because, you know, all women are so...
All women were bitches.
Yeah. So were you like, I'm just going to stick with the boys at first? Or, like, how did you transition to liking women?
I was friends with both because, like, I was like that in high school too, friends with both, but, like, I was more friends. Like, I got more guy friends when I first started than the girls. And then once I started meeting women that actually cared and weren't, like, stuck up or in their little clique or whatever, then those are the women I started sticking with. Like, I still have more guy friends than I have female friends, mm-hmm. but, like, that's starting to change now that I'm in the Fearless Women's meeting, because mm-hmm. It's all women, and it's, like, so great to actually connect with them and be able to actually reach out to them. Like, since I became into this sponsee family, mm-hmm. Our sponsorship family, it's been so much different. Like, because there's, like, 35 of us in that sponsorship family.
Oh, my goodness. That's a lot of people. A lot of women.
Yeah, and then we have dinner once a month, which was just starting again this month, which is exciting.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it's great to connect to other females.
And yeah.
It took me about, I would say, 3 to 6 months before I started transitioning into, okay, women aren't bitches.
Yeah. I relate to that. I remember thinking, like, well, girls are going to get in the way of me getting guys, or girls are going to get in the way of me, like, I don't know what I thought they were. I just thought that they were bad. I was like, I'm not going to be able to connect to a woman. I am totally right. like a dude on the inside. Like, you don't know me. And then I started connecting with women and I was like, okay, wait, I know why I don't like you. I can't manipulate you because you see right through right. every single thing that I'm saying. Like, it was like, this isn't fair. I can't be an alcoholic around you. I can't get away with anything, you know? And that's why right. I love the woman that I have in my life today, because I actually appreciate that now. It's funny how things change, you know?
Yeah. Like, I have one friend that I've had for 25 years, and that was it. Like, I don't know how we clicked or anything, because we are total opposites.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the only friend that I've had. And now, like, she gets jealous because I have other friends that are girls that I hang out with now. I'm like, you're in Pennsylvania. I'm down here. What am I supposed to do? Not hang out with people?
Yeah, that would not be good for any of us if we just isolated all the time. Yeah.
Right. But yeah, no, I love females now. And I couldn't say that before, because, like you said, you can't manipulate them. They yeah. know what you're talking. They know what you're about to say or what you're going to do.
Oh, yeah.
So
I love when a girl calls me and she's talking about a boy, and I'm like, okay, let me tell you what your plans are, because I just want to see if we're that similar. And then I'll say it. They're like, were you, like, in my head reading my mind? And I'm like, no, I'm just like you. That's all I want to say. I'm just like you.
Right. Yeah. And this is my suggestion to you.
Yeah. And so don't do that. Let's do something else. You want to hang out?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's so cool. Well, I think we're about to wrap it up. So is there anything you would like to say, anything that's in your heart that you would like to say?
The only thing I would like to say is, if you're new and you're struggling, you know, there's so many people you can reach out to. You can reach out to the Wings of Recovery Network. We are on Facebook. But even that, like, just pick up the phone and call somebody, because you're not alone. There are so many people that are just like you and that can relate to you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Melissa. We really enjoyed having you on here.
Thank you. I'm glad you guys had me on here. I really appreciate it.
We really appreciate your vulnerability as well.
Thank you. It's kind of hard.